Blog Talk Radio.
Talk radio program. I'm your host, Susan Laris and Dan. And today, I sense this is going to be quite the free-flowing, interesting conversation. And we have a guest coming on today whose name is Rizwan Virk. And Riz has truly shown how to walk between worlds, essentially, or to integrate many facets of spirituality into life and to work and into work. Riz is a high-tech entrepreneur. He's an independent filmmaker. He's an angel investor and a spiritual seeker. His book is called Zen Entrepreneurship, Walking the Path of the Career Warrior. And it has quite a following, and he recently released an updated second edition of this book that a number of people are paying attention to. And I'm still working with the book. This is the kind of book that takes time to really integrate. And it's certainly having an impact on me already and my path. Riz is the producer of multiple films. Many people are no doubt aware of Thrive, What on Earth Will It Take? He was the executive producer of Thrive. And he also is co-executive producer of Sirius, which was released not long ago, an eye-opening documentary about UFOs. Riz's entrepreneurial journey began very young, at the age of 23, and his book talks about the early part of his journey. He started his first high-tech company at that time and grew it into a multi-million dollar venture, and he has since been very active in the startup world. He created Tapfish, a mobile game that has been downloaded 30 million times, probably even more than that now. He studied computer science at MIT, and management science at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. So I really am so delighted to bring Riz on the program because I feel a very personal connection to some of what he's sharing. I feel he has a lot of lessons to share. Listeners to my show know that I started out in the software industry, and I kind of took a different path right now where I'm really focused on spirituality. And I think a lot of people do this where they go from one to the other. And what Riz has to share, I think, is going to help us all in better understanding integration, a really important area. So without further delay, I am just so happy to welcome Riz on the program. Hi, Riz.
Hi, Susan, how are you this morning?
Doing really well. I thought that maybe the best way to start with this is, since your story is it just unfolds in such an interesting way, why don't you take us back, Riz, to where this all started with you? How did this all begin?
Sure. So, you know, the story itself begins when I was a fresh graduate, out of MIT, and my roommate and I wanted to start a software company. And to be totally honest with you, I wasn't that interested in spirituality. time.
Yes.
Certainly not a lot of esoteric subjects that I talk about in the book, including things like, you know, dream yoga and what happens in the astral worlds and all of these types of things,
yeah,
meditation
no, I
and
get
yoga.
That.
I had grown up in sort of lower middle class in Detroit and had tons of student loans after graduating, and I just wanted to make some money.
This
meditation stuff can help me somehow, right, in being more successful in my business and my career. Well, sure, I'll give it a try. And, you know, in the book I talk about an apprenticeship that I began with a spiritual teacher, you know, at the time, and he kind of guided me through a bunch of different techniques and perspectives on how the hidden worlds impact the physical worlds. And so, you know, during that time, I was growing my software business, and we were doing pretty well. We ended up raising some venture capital financing, a few million dollars, and things were going along pretty nicely. And then at one point, the business hit a wall, and it turned out that the issues that, you know, my business was dealing with were the same issues that I was dealing with in my personal growth.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that in order to deal with the issues in the business, I had to deal with these personal issues in what I call our my energetic pattern. And so I started off thinking that meditation and yoga and spiritual practice could help me with my work, but really where I ended up was that everything that happened in my career and in my job and my business, the challenges that I face are usually a direct reflection of these inner challenges that I need to work on. So I realized I had it backwards. Really, you know, our careers are here to help us with our spiritual growth. And if we keep that in mind, we can have a very different perspective in how we deal with those challenges.
Yes. And you know, Riz, I really do personally know, including my own journey, is that a lot of times we go through this path of leaving. You know, we just withdraw from that corporate world if we enter into the spiritual world. And that's not an easy thing to do at all financially. I mean, sometimes you can make it go, but most people have challenges. And I think, you know, the way that you talk about integrating, even maybe you can talk a little bit about how I found really fascinating this business of work being a kind of meditation, that focus. That was a really important lesson that came through early on, how you integrate that into work.
Sure, absolutely. So if you think about meditation, right, most people think of it as something that you do, you know, separate from your work and your career and even your personal life. It's you're taking time away. You know, you're taking 10 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour, however long you meditate, you know, sitting off near an altar or off in the corner on a cushion or at a Zen monastery, right?
Exactly.
Zazen, as they call it, sitting and meditating. But if you think about what happens in meditation, in the early days, it's usually about building our concentration. Now, the eventual goal of meditation is not necessarily concentration. It's an expanded awareness of what's happening in the world. But it usually starts off, most meditation techniques usually start off by saying focus in on your breath or focus in on a specific part of the body, maybe an energy center, or maybe you're focused on a mandala, or maybe you have a mantra that you're repeating. But in any case, you know, what will happen after a few minutes is our minds will start to wander, right? We'll be thinking about what are we going to have for lunch, you know, what is it that we're going to do this weekend. We start thinking about that remark that we should have made in the meeting yesterday, but we didn't think of it in time.
Especially
we thought
that.
Of it after the fact.
Yeah.
Right? So our mind is constantly wandering to the past and to the future, right? Anywhere but the present. And
right.
As we meditate, we learn to bring our mind back to the focus of attention during the meditation. And that's like there's a mental muscle, I like to call it, that gets exercised over time. And the more you do it, you know, the better at it you become. Well, turns out you can do this same kind of process of learning to exercise that mental muscle at work. And, you know, this story of Zen entrepreneurship took place in the 90s when email was relatively new, and that was, you know, one of the distractions that happens. But today, no matter what we're doing, we have all kinds of distractions, right? We have SMS messages, we have Twitter,
social media.
We have Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have social media, you know, and cell phones. So between mobile and social, we've got all kinds of distractions coming at us.
True.
All kinds of different ways. So no matter what we're doing, usually we're going to get distracted. So you can kind of say that I'm going to take, you know, this next task as what I like to call a warrior's task. And a warrior's task is a task that has an obvious purpose and a non-obvious or hidden purpose. And the best way to think about this is from that old film in the 1980s, The Karate Kid. Did you ever see that
film?
Oh,
yeah. I love the movies in your book. They're just with my generation. They're perfect.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah. You know, I grew up in the 80s, so I may end up quoting 80s
films
a lot more
than... Yeah, I'm a little before you, but I so appreciated the movie analogies. I know I saw some note where somebody asked that you update, or you said you weren't going to update him or something, and I thought, I'm really glad you have the ones that you have, because they certainly speak to many of us. So anyway, yeah, talk about The Karate Kid. That's a great example.
Yeah, so, you know, in that film, the teacher, Mr. Miyagi, is supposed to teach Daniel, the student, karate, and instead he has him do these household chores. He has him paint the fence, and he has him, you know, wax the floor. And after a while, Daniel gets upset, and he says, well, you're supposed to be teaching me karate, not having me do your chores, right? But it turns out that he was teaching him the instinctive motions so that his muscles would get used to these motions that were quite useful in karate, so he could block kicks and punches. So there was a hidden purpose to the task. Well, if we think of our work as a series of warrior's tasks, we can take a task. Let's say we have to do data entry into a spreadsheet, or we have to, you know, write a report on something. But we can say for the next hour or 2 hours, you know, this is going to be my warrior's task. So the obvious purpose of this task is to get it done, right? Because your boss said you have to get it done, or maybe it's something you need for your own business. But the hidden purpose is to actually exercise the muscle of attention and to train your mind. So what will naturally happen after a little while is you will get distracted, right? Somebody will come by saying, hey, do you want to grab some coffee? Or you'll get a pop-up text message, or you'll get a push notification from apps, right? I've been in the apps world, and it's a whole new way to interrupt people.
To be interrupted, yes.
So there are so many ways to be interrupted, and of course we're going to be interrupted, and we can't always help that. But what we can do is say, okay, well, I'm not going to pay attention to that at the moment. I'm going to acknowledge that distraction, and then I'm going to bring my mind back to the task at hand. And as you do this over a period of time, of course, there's the external interruptions, but again, you'll have the internal interruptions, right? You'll again jump forward to, you know, that thing you have to take care of at the house, or, you know, you got to get the oil change in the car, whatever it is. Your mind will wander. And then so once again, you bring your mind back. And if you do that over a certain period of time, and it's useful to say, okay, I'm going to spend an hour or 2 hours on this, I found, and I talk about this in the book, then really you're using your work as a kind of meditation. You're actually building up the same muscles of attention and concentration that, certainly in early stage meditation, is what it's all about. So that's one example of integrating the two so that they're not seen as totally separate tasks.
Yeah.
And totally separate worlds.
It's a valuable message, Riz, because so often, and believe me, I've been through this, you know, where I'll have various people on that are really expert meditators. One guy, he's been meditating every day for over 40 years, you know, traditional. He was trained with the guru of the Beatles and all this. And, you know, as I'm talking to these people, I'm like, gosh, you know, I don't really meditate. And actually, it's an area I should work on. But, you know, maybe I do walking meditation. But as I was reading your book, I was thinking, you know, there are many forms of meditation, and I think maybe some of us are doing it, and we don't even know it. Like when I used to be a programmer, you'd get into the flow of it so hard. And I know everyone who has some creative passion and they're working on it, I mean, you don't want to be interrupted when you're in that place, you know. And I've known programmers, they will shut themselves off, I mean, and they need to, because they have to be in that zone. That's what I would call it, the zone.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, particularly
with
programming.
And it's a meditative thing. Yeah, it really is. And I would bet it's true of a lot of problems. So, I mean, I know Einstein used to follow, like, light streams and things. I mean, he obviously was really in on some higher techniques in the way that he would intuit things.
I absolutely agree. I've been reading a lot about Einstein and and a lot of his quotes, and he talks about how imagination is sometimes more important than knowledge. And, you know, he was very, I think, adept at following his intuition and then bringing it back later into the scientific realm, right?
Yeah.
And so he was able to balance the two. And I think that's, you know, that's an important point as well. So some of us don't follow our intuition a lot, and the book is very much about learning to follow your intuition, looking for the clues around you and treating life as a treasure hunt. But then, you know, some of us are very logical, you know, on the other side, and I think you have to find a balance of the two in the world. We can follow our intuition, but then we also need to be able to bring it back into something practical if we want to be successful in the real world as well.
Right. You know, when you talk about following the clues, I mean, that's something I think I'd like to explore some more, this idea of a treasure hunt and, you know, also integrating into that the concept of how the future relates to us, essentially. I mean, somehow they're all related, the hidden worlds, all of that. So I'm going to give you the opportunity to really talk some more about the clues. Where are they coming from? What about the hidden worlds? That's a really interesting aspect of your book, that term, hidden world. Synchronicity, we hear about it all the time. We see it. Many of us are seeing it almost constantly as you get in the flow. I know that has to do with the clues. So anyway, speak of all of that. I'll just give you the floor to talk about all that.
Sure. So, you know, the book talks about the seven types of clues that are talking to us all the time. And actually there's more than seven types, but that's just a way of categorizing, you know, the different types of clues that come up in our own personal treasure hunt. So, you know, in the book I talk about finding a way to treat your life and your career in particular as if it were a treasure hunt. And I'll use another 80s movie example. So I don't know if you've seen the Indiana Jones films from the 80s.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I've seen Indiana Jones
and the Last Crusade. And, you know, in those films, yeah, I used to love those films as a kid, and I still do. But in those films, there was usually a spiritual treasure that they were trying to find at the end of their treasure hunt, whether it was the Ark of the Covenant or it was the Holy Grail. And to find it, they had to follow the clues. And unfortunately, you know, the clues weren't all just laid out all at once, right? Usually they had to follow the first clue, which then led them to the second clue, which then led them to the third clue. And if they were adept at following the clues, they would eventually get to the treasure. And so, you know, if we can adopt that perspective in our lives, we will find that there is a treasure that's waiting for us. And it's not necessarily a physical treasure, but it is getting in touch with that higher part of ourselves that is directing us, to be the person that we were meant to be. And, you know, the psychologist Carl Jung talked about how psychology and psychiatry shouldn't just be about mental disorders. It should be about helping people become the person they were meant to be. And that's really what following the clues is all about. It's about learning to use your intuition to look for the guidance that's there, but we may not even be aware of it. And once we do that, we start to realize that there's more and more of these clues all around us. And you mentioned synchronicity, which is the perfect sort of type of clue, right, which is when we're thinking of something internally and then something externally happens that relates to that, but there's no causal connection, right, is a meaningful coincidence and the two are related in some way that has meaning to us personally. Well, that can happen in many different ways. Obviously, the simplest example being you're thinking of somebody and then they call you the next day. And that kind of thing happens to many of us, but I like to call that a glitch in the matrix. It's revealing a higher order pattern that we aren't always paying attention to. And there are many different types of clues. I like to talk about funny feelings that we get when we see something, whether it's a feeling of deja vu or it's a feeling that's sparked internally by something that we see externally.
Yes.
There's another type of clue, the errant phrase. I'll give you a great example. A friend of mine was trying to buy property, real estate, in Phoenix a few years back, and she looked at, you know, many, many different places and couldn't find one that she liked, and she was getting a little down because everybody seemed to be buying new homes, and she wasn't able to find one.
Right.
And so she was driving along the road, and she noticed this bumper sticker on the car in front of her, and the bumper sticker said, "Not all those who wander are lost." She said, "Oh, that's kind of interesting message," but she had never heard the phrase before, and so she kind of took it in and forgot about it. And then she was browsing the web somewhere, and she came across the same phrase again. Said, not all those who wander are lost. And so there you have repetition of a clue that's very personalized for her.
Yeah.
And then she saw it again in a book. And then she came to me and said, you know, where is this from? I keep seeing this all over the place. And I said, well, I think it's from Lord of the Rings. It's part of a poem. You know, not
mm-hmm.
all that is
yeah.
gold glitters and not all those who wander are lost. But mm-hmm. she wasn't a fan of that genre, and she didn't like the Lord of the Rings even. Yet this message came through for her very much about her, you know, her finding a home, and she took the message to heart that it was okay not to buy, but to continue to rent and move around. And then turns out, you know, a year or two later, not only did the housing market crash, but she didn't want to live in Phoenix anymore, and she was glad she didn't have a mortgage to worry
uh-huh.
about, and she was able to move. So that's an example where, you know, a clue is very meaningful to us, and we, as by following the clue, we get in touch with a higher order pattern that we can't necessarily see.
Seems like a lot of us are seeing radio synchronicities, where, especially if you drive a lot, that's when I see it the most, just the perfect song. Just comes. I can even echo your thoughts. I mean, it can be pretty intense, pretty magical when this happens. I'm curious if you've encountered that much, where the radio just seems to just magically do similar things to that bumper sticker in a way.
Yeah, you know, radio is a great place for that. You know, sometimes just browsing late night TV is a great
yeah,
place
yeah.
for synchronicity. I found a few years ago, this is before emails were so good at spam filtering, that sometimes your email spam, you know,
uh-huh.
ends up having an interesting message. Like a few years ago, I was starting a company, and we were contemplating whether to raise venture capital financing and what path to take the company on. And I just happened to be browsing my email, and I just caught, you know, this kind of spam email that said something like, venture capital ruined my company, or something like that. And I said, oh, well, that's an interesting message. I thought about it, and, you know, we ended up not raising any money for that company. But when I went back to find that email, I couldn't even find it again. So I don't know if I had imagined it or if it was actually in my spam folder. But that was a case where a phrase jumped out at me. And I think that's really the key, is what jumps out at you personally. I mean, if the two of us were in a bookstore, we would, you know, we might be attracted to completely different books and completely different types of messages because we're maybe in very different places in our lives. Yes. And so clues are highly personalized. Now, the question that you asked earlier is a good one. You know, where do they come from, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you'll get different answers depending on who you ask. You know, my contention is just that they come from the hidden worlds, and they come from another part of ourselves. Some people would say they come from guides, spiritual guides. Some people might say they come from angels. Some people might say they come from God. You know, I tend to have more of an engineering and scientific bent, so
yes.
I prefer descriptions which are more mechanical. And you know, I was just talking with another mentor of mine a few weeks ago, Robert Moss, who teaches about shamanic
uh-huh.
framework, and we were talking about
him.
Yeah, so, you know, I studied with Robert for a while as well, and
mm-hmm.
you know, we were talking about this idea of there are many future selves out there with different probabilities, and it's very possible that the different future selves are sending us messages back to our present self. So
yeah.
now you're involving an element of communication through time. And in the book, I talk about, you know, that very first company I started that the book is about involved this technology called Lotus Notes, which was a collaboration technology. Well, a year or two before that, when I was still in college, we had entered a business plan competition, and somehow I came across this technology, and I had that funny feeling, like, this technology is important somehow. I don't know why, and we ended up writing a business plan, you know, based on the idea of collaboration. We didn't really even understand what the technology was. We just kind of got intrigued by it and said, we're going to use it for some kind of collaboration. And
yeah.
we named the company business plan Brainstorm Technologies because it was about collaborating. Well, when we actually started the company a few years later, you know, we called it Brainstorm, but it was very much
uh-huh.
about this technology, Lotus Notes. So you could say that one of the reasons I started the company was because I had been intrigued by it in college by that same technology. Or you could say the reason I had been intrigued by that technology in college was because one of my future selves, the one that I read about in the book, right, and the one that I remember now, was going to start a company in the future based on this technology,
yeah.
and therefore there was a jog in my intuition. And as you get down, you know, to the level of quantum physics, and you get down to you know, these types of areas, it's harder and harder to distinguish between cause and effect. And, you know, A caused B, but A has to be before B rather than being after B. You get into all kinds of areas of speculation at this point because nobody really knows exactly how it works.
Yeah. I have a question for you, kind of deploying my own engineering background here. What if you send consciously send a message to yourself? What if right now Riz in the future, who's this incredibly successful person, knows who you were in the past, in a meditation communicates to that person consciously? Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever thought to consciously, not just, you know, this mysterious communication from the future, but actually consciously mentoring yourself in the past? Does that happen?
You know, I think that's a really interesting area. And I have thought about it, actually. The times that I've thought about it have been usually when there's a link between physical location. So, for example, I was just in Boston for the 4th of July. I live in California now, and you know, I lived in Boston for many years, and the book takes place in Boston. And sometimes when I'm walking around certain areas like Harvard Square or MIT, you know, I will sense this that there's this open conduit, right, between my present self, who's standing, say, at MIT in 2013, and my past self, who maybe in 1993 was just, or 92, was just graduating from MIT.
Right.
And I believe that, you know, that certain points in time are linked and easier for us to communicate back than other points in time. And, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know if you've ever seen that, the TV show Fringe, which was on a few years ago.
You know, I didn't really get into it. I was supposed to, but I didn't. But yeah,
well,
tell
in that
me
show,
about it.
And there's a lot about parallel universes, and you know, there's multiple versions of ourselves, and you know, sometimes as I talk about the speculation of future selves, you know, sometimes I wonder if we're also communicating with parallel selves who are doing, you know, what we're doing, but may have made different choices, and sometimes I believe we can tap into these parallel selves and bring back some abilities. Now, in the show Fringe, one of the main character was this woman, Olivia Dunham, who is an FBI agent in this reality. And in the alternate universe, she was also an FBI agent, although they didn't have an FBI. They just called them fringe agents. And she was an expert marksman who had won the Olympics for, you know, for shooting, like, rifles. And she was, the Olivia in this universe, was able to pick up that skill by tapping into the Olivia in the other universe. So that's an example where, you know, obviously that's fiction, but I do believe that as we make different choices in lives, if there really are parallel lives of us, that we may have different skill sets and different aptitudes, and that we can tap into those and bring back some of the best part of ourselves from these other lives into our current self. And that's a whole different way of manifesting things in our lives and becoming more successful at things. And for example, I've been very successful as an entrepreneur. I've now moved on to mentoring and investing in entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
But, you know, now that I'm older, a little more successful, I tend not to be as organized anymore as I may have been in the past, because now I have people who take care of these things, right?
Yet,
you know, very recently I was meditating and saw an image of myself wearing a suit, which I never do anymore. I mean, I don't even know if I own a suit anymore because I live in Silicon Valley.
And I'm in Oregon, same way.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But
that would be like me wearing a dress to try to do work. No.
Well, there you go.
But yeah,
and so,
go ahead.
You know, in fact, it was funny. We were shooting a pilot for a TV show on disruptive technologies this weekend on free energy, new energy technologies. And they said, well, why don't you wear a suit? You're supposed to be a venture capitalist. I said, I don't even know if I have a suit anymore. It's been so long. But anyway, I was in a meditation and I saw an image of myself wearing a suit, working for one of these big consulting companies as a partner, and it was just a very different personality than I've come to recognize in myself in this life, in a very different set of circumstances, but the same underlying person. And so, you know, I came up with this idea that if I could tap a little bit more into, you know, some of the discipline that this other version of myself has, while still continuing to be, you know, my kind of free-flowing self in this life,
yes.
that there would be some benefit to that, because it is just a different aspect of ourselves. And I think that's another way to manifest, and it's something that people don't talk about, is that it's easier for us to manifest certain things if a future self or a parallel self, you know, has some aptitude and was meant to do those things or has done those things,
yes.
as opposed to something that we were never meant to do and that has nothing to do with our path, but we've stumbled upon something and say we want it, and therefore we want to manifest it, you know?
Yeah. You know, I've heard more and more people talk about how past lives and future lives aren't really past or future. On here we're talking reincarnation, but that they're simultaneous. Because is time really linear? You know, we think of time being linear, but it really isn't linear. I mean, and so, and I've even heard it said that you could actually acquire a skill from one of your other incarnations this way, if you view it as simultaneously. This gets kind of out there in esoteric thinking. This is why you're a great guest to have on, because we don't usually get to explore this kind of thing. It's kind of fun, but it really makes you think about it.
And it really does. I think there's something to that. You know, mystics will tell us that all points in time exist, you know, simultaneously in time and space. In fact, there was this gentleman who, Ben Rich, I believe, who was the head of Lockheed Skunk Works, right, which did all of the classified projects for the government. And, you know, after he had retired, he was speaking at a university, and we tell this story in the film Sirius, where, you know, at the end, one of the people asked, you know, are there other things that you haven't told us about? And he kind of opened up and said, you know, one, we have the technology to take E.T. home. Now he's referring to, you know, the old movie E.T.
where
he wanted to go home and he needed a spaceship to do it. But two, he said that all points in time and space, you know, are linked together and are happening simultaneously. And that was the key. So it wasn't just about being able to create some new type of engine, although that obviously is important if you're talking about technology, but that there was some element of consciousness that links all these places and times together, so that not only was it possible to travel, you know, far away by going through some type of Einstein-Rosen bridge or wormhole to get there quickly without having to go through space, but that you could potentially do something similar through time. It was an enigmatic statement, and he never explained it, but this is the guy who's in charge of, you know, many of these government classified
projects. Yeah, that's interesting.
So that's from a technological point of view, I think that's interesting. It's kind of out there, right, for most engineers. But as we go back to the spiritual side, I mean, I have some personal experience with this, where, you know, years ago I went to the Monroe Institute. Are you familiar with that? They're down in West Virginia, I think, or Virginia.
Uh-huh. I've heard of it. I don't know too much about it.
Founded by Robert Monroe, and it was all about trying to induce out-of-body experiences with different types of frequencies and sounds in different ears, right? So he developed this technology. And so I was there in a meditative state doing this thing, and I was sort of leaning back. So I was sitting up, leaning back, and, you know, contemplating how to have an out-of-body experience, right? And for some reason, the technology that he developed wasn't really working that well for me. It was like these different frequencies in each ear. And years later, you know, I would learn, you know, with Robert Moss to just do it using drumming. Like, you don't necessarily need super high-tech things to do it.
Yeah.
You can induce different states just by different, you know, different rates of drumming. But I had this experience, this vision, where I saw a person who kind of looked like me, but this was a different time and a different place. It was in India or Pakistan, and I was born in Pakistan in this life. And, you know, he had a beard, and he was clearly a yogi. You know, he had a loincloth, and he was sitting on a mountaintop, and he was doing these different breathing exercises. And he kind of said to me, okay, you're doing it wrong. If you really want to leave your body, this is how you should do it. And he said, sit up a little more, because I was leaning back. He goes, because you want to stay awake. And he kind of guided me. And during that process, I was able to kind of – and in his time, he was sitting against a tree. And so – and I was sitting, you know, back up against a cushion. But there was this weird synchronicity between that experience and this experience, and he was sort of mentoring me because he had done it many times. And so that's an example of going back. I don't know if it was a past life, it was just a visualization of my subconscious mind, you know, but it was very real, and he did give
and
me
it
very practical instruction.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, do you feel that you're, I have found on the spiritual path, I have to tell you, I'm constantly looking for proof. It's like, I love it. I love proof of things, you know, and not only just for me, and I will relate this to something else related to you. You are so open, Riz, right from the beginning, you know, where you would just listen. And so many people are very closed. You know, they just, even right at the outset, you know, one of your colleagues says, you know, how can you use, you know, spiritual practices for related to money and that kind of, but not only that, just some of this fringe stuff I put in quotes, you know, which quickly you get into. And yet a lot of people are uncomfortable talking about it. I go through this all the time. I think, oh my gosh, you know, my colleagues, I mean, I used to be just a regular engineer. I mean, I did a lot of stuff. And if they knew what I was doing, it's like sometimes I have to cringe a little. And I think, oh gosh, so-and-so just followed me on LinkedIn and now he's listening to my show. And it's like, I have to go through this, Riz. And yet I know it's real. It's real. I mean, this stuff is real. And I just, I mean, what, are you interested in reality or not? That's kind of what I feel like. In fact, if any of them are listening, that's my comment to them right now. Is that, do you really want to know what's real about the world? I mean, that's what it comes down to. But anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. But how have you done this, Riz? Because it's important. It really is important to many of us.
In terms of how I'm
just opening up, you know, what's your secret? Do you know? Do you know how you've managed to just be so open about, you know, who you are and be an engineer and just be open?
Well, it starts as a state of mind, and I think it's a process as well. It's interesting you talk about, you know, worrying about, you know, what will your colleagues think, right?
I very much
had those same concerns, actually.
Yeah.
Particularly towards the end of the book, you know, I talk about my own hesitation in sharing this stuff, right? Especially, I was in Boston, which is a much more conservative world in terms of startups than out here, even in Silicon Valley.
I believe it.
The venture capital, the financial industry there is, you know, kind of old school, right? Very, very conservative. And I thought, what will they think, right? You know, when I try to raise money for my next software company, they'll be like, you're the guy who wrote that weird book about that, and that was my, you know, set of fears, right, that I had about opening up and really owning these experiences that I had. And in fact, you know, I wrote the first edition of this book many years ago. I mean, I think it was in 2004.
Yeah, that's even brave.
yeah, back then. And it was, you know, I found, and we'll talk about, you know, manifestation a little bit later, but, you know, I found that even though I had written the book, there were lots of obstacles that were coming in my path, and it felt like an uphill battle to get the book out there. And some of those obstacles were internal, right? Part of me didn't really want to own these very esoteric subjects while I was still running a startup that was still trying to raise money. And so I had these internal fears, and they stood in the way of my being more successful as an author. And so, you know, I ended up just kind of stepping back and after a while not really promoting the book until the clues told me it was the right time to do that last year. And now it's a very different experience, right? I've been out there talking about the book on national radio shows.
I heard you first.
And so, you know, I was in a very different place. But I think for me it was a process, right? It was a process of learning to follow my intuition and then having that intuition validated. And sometimes people ask me, well, has your intuition ever led you astray or led you in the wrong direction? Well, of course it has, right? And that's why I think it's important, you know, that we have to develop our own navigational system. I like to think of it as our own personal GPS. We each have different types of clues that speak to us more than others. Like for me, dreams is a big one. I will see things in my dreams sometimes, and then the next day that person will call me or somebody, you know, related to them will contact me. Or if I contact them, like I had this happen just the other week, I had a dream about a friend I hadn't seen in years. And so, you know, I just sent her a quick email because now I've learned that when I see somebody in a dream that I haven't thought about in a while, there's probably a reason.
Right.
She got right back to me and she goes, oh, yeah, I've been thinking about contacting you. I'm writing this business plan and I really needed your advice on what to put in the business plan. And that was, you know, within a day of my having that dream. And, again, I hadn't, you know, dreamed of her in a long time. So it was interesting that would happen. But I think each of us has to figure out we have certain aptitudes and that we can perceive certain types of clues more easily than other types of clues, and that when we follow those clues, we need to be able to validate them as well. So we don't just go jump off the deep end because of one clue. But on the other hand, if
right.
a clue keeps coming again and again, then we know there's something there. Repetition is so the two rules of clues are, one, is it unusual? Like I just mentioned, this dream with this friend that was, you know, I hadn't thought of in a while, or the phrase earlier that my other friend had seen on a bumper sticker, not all those who wander are lost. It was an unusual phrase. Or was the feeling invoked by it unusual? And then the second rule of clues is, do they repeat in some way? I like to say sometimes we need to take a half step towards a clue and then wait to see if it validates itself. And that is a way of bridging the gap between intuition and logic, because, you know, we do have to do things in the real world to achieve our goals, yet our intuition is sometimes pointing out a direction. And clues are good at pointing out directions, but we still have to go in that direction. And if there's, you know, a muddy creek, we have to get over it. We have to be very cognizant of what's actually there in the physical world and in the real world, and not just be totally, you know, in our minds all the time. And I'll give you an example of another clue of my own from a few years ago. We had started a company in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we couldn't figure out the name for the company. So we went back and forth between our three co-founders, and we just couldn't decide. So I ended up going home to visit my parents in Michigan for the holidays. And as I was in Michigan, I ended up going to Ann Arbor, probably to meet an old friend or something. And as I was driving on Interstate 94, I looked over and there was this building that had this name of a software company on it. And the name was Arbor Text. And I had heard of the name before, but something about it just sort of jumped out. I had never seen it on that freeway, and even though I'd been to Michigan many times before and had driven that same route. So as I got home, I had this funny feeling that this was important somehow, and so I let it sit with me for a while, and it wasn't until I got back to Boston that I realized, oh, these guys in Ann Arbor had named their software company after their home college town of you know, from the University of Michigan, and they called it ArborText, and why don't we do the same thing? So we ended up calling our company Cambridge Documents, and we didn't want to be too close to them, otherwise we would have called it Cambridge Text. But that was an example where a funny feeling, noticing something along a route that I had been along many times and hadn't seen it before. Following that, I took the first step of saying, okay, what does this mean? And then the second step of discussing it with my co-founders, we ended up choosing a name for the company that we all liked. But that wasn't the end of the story. So that was sort of the first step of the clue. But that company just kept staying in my mind, like, this company is important. So I went on their website and reached out to the founders of that company. And then on my next vacation home to see my parents, like I think 6 months later, I went and showed them our product. And we were just a small startup with three guys at the time. And these guys were well established and they had huge customers. Yeah. And to make a long story short, they loved our product. It took them a while. It took them a year, and this is where, you know, doing the logical, real-world stuff is important, but they ended up being our biggest customer, and they took us into all these big companies like Boeing and Toyota, companies we would never have made it into on our own because we were so small. Mm-hmm. And so that's a case where, you know, following this clue, I had to follow it several times before I got to the end of that story.
Yeah, and you know, this may be a good entry point into, you know, how do we really make these things happen? I mean, I know you have the diamond of manifestation in your book, and, you know, given that this show is flying by, I had a feeling it might, you know, we can't not talk about that, boy. We should really, what do you have to say about manifestation, Riz? Because I know you've looked at that a lot.
Yeah, I've looked at that. I've thought about it. I've thought about, you know, people that I know that have been successful in manifesting things.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, very often We try to manifest something and it doesn't happen, right? At least
yeah.
not right away. And so, you know, in the book I talk about the diamond of manifestation, or really the four keys to manifestation.
Yeah.
And I think that too often we focus on one of these keys and not another, and we sort of lose sight of the of why something may be happening or may not be happening within the time frame that we ask for it. And let me run through these four keys, and I'll describe them each briefly, and it's really more how they're interrelated.
Uh-huh.
And the first key is what I call right intent. And that is, in fact, trying to figure out what you would like to manifest. And, you know, there's a long tradition of, you know, going back to creative visualization, lately the Law of Attraction and The Secret,
mm-hmm.
You know, has been really popular. This tradition goes back to the 1920s when Andrew Carnegie had commissioned Napoleon Hill to write Think and Grow Rich, and Florence Shin, who did more of a spiritual bent on it in The Game of
uh-huh.
Life. And this tradition has been out there for a while, and the basic rule is ask and ye shall receive.
Yes.
And I do believe in that basic rule. So we do have to set our intent, and we usually do that by visualizing something. Now, sometimes we ask and we don't receive, and not at least not right away.
Right.
And that's where it becomes a little more difficult and a little more complicated. So, you know, that first key, which is setting our intent, usually we think of it as just, you know, a very kind of selfish process. Gimme, gimme. This is what I want, right?
True.
$100,000, sir. I want a big house, right?
Uh-huh.
But I believe we also have to learn to listen. And that's where the process of meditation and yoga are both very effective in helping us tap into our intuition. And sometimes it's easier to hold an image and give energy to that image that has come to us naturally during a meditation or afterwards or while we're in the shower. Right? Sometimes when an image comes to us, it is a glimpse of a possible future. This gets back to what we were talking about earlier. And it's a lot easier for us to set our intent towards that future than it is towards something that's completely unrelated and that we may or may not, you know, that may or may not be a part of our path of life. You know, I'll use an extreme example. Suppose I decide I want to be an NBA basketball player, right? And I can visualize that all I want. But
it's
the fact of the
happen.
Matter is, you know, I'm 5'6", and I'm not very athletic, right? And I'm in my 40s now, and that's just probably not going to happen, right? We have to be real, right?
Right.
Now, that's an extreme example, but I think too often we do choose goals that are inappropriate for us, and if we had just been better at listening to what might be in store for us as a possible future, we would be much more successful at it. So that's the first key is right intent. But I also believe sometimes when people set their intent, they push too hard rather than listening, and other times they hold on too tightly. You know, one of the things that the Zen tradition of Buddhism and a lot of meditation traditions teach us is to not be so attached to the outcome.
Yeah.
And if we're so attached to one thing, you know, we become like what I remember one of my investors called a salesperson back in my first meeting. She was an ankle biter. She would like grab your ankle and hold on to it until you gave her the sale.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh.
Like really intensely.
We all know people like that. Yes.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, sometimes that works, but you know, when we're talking about a process of spiritual manifestation, oftentimes that leads more to disillusionment and frustration because we're holding on too tightly rather than learning to let go. And now this touches on how we hold our energy, because when I say, what do I mean when I say we hold on to something too tight? Like, is it in our minds? Is it in our bodies?
Mm-hmm.
Where is that tightness happen? And so the second key to manifestation is what I call right patterns. And that is in understanding your own energetic pattern and how you have manifested things in the past. And I think too often people completely, you know, ignore that there is an element of self-reflection in successful manifestation. And that is ties directly to what I was talking about at the very beginning of the interview, where I said my energetic pattern was getting in the way of my business being successful. And what did I mean by that? What I meant was that I had this pattern back then, and I still have it to a certain extent, but not as intensely, where I would jump into something, get into it, you know, fully, do pretty well at it, and then I get bored with it and want to move on to the next
mm-hmm.
thing. I jump into that and do that fully for a little while, and I get bored, and then I'd want to move on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this pattern had happened before in my external life, in high school, in college, and now this was my very first startup, and my very first startup was doing too many things. And when you go into business for yourself, you find that your personality is directly reflected in your business, whether you want it to or not.
Yeah.
It just happens.
Yeah.
Right? Unconsciously, it just happens. And so our business was doing too many things, and that was getting in the way of our ability to be successful. Now, it doesn't mean we shouldn't do different things or experiment, but it was the fact that we were doing too many of them at once that was the problem. That was a direct reflection of my internal pattern. And these patterns end up manifesting themselves in the outside world, in our lives, again and again. And it's not just in business. I mean, in personal relationships too, right? We all know people who've been through multiple relationships. They were with different people, but they were the same kind of relationship again and again.
Oh, that happens a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that is a direct reflection of the what I call the energetic pattern of the person. They are making decisions along the way that is attracting or repelling certain types of relationships, and the decisions are very much based upon their own energy and how they feel. Another type of clue that we didn't talk about is the bodily sensation. Like, how do we feel? We've all had the experience where we've gone into, say, a meeting and somebody's saying all the right things, but we come out and our stomach is clenched and we feel very strange about it, right? That's a bodily sensation of a clue that says, you know, maybe, you know, we should be careful with this person and not jump in right away.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes if your pattern is to jump into things right away, you may not get that clenching. Every time you hear a new idea, you may get this nice rush of energy and think, wow, this is so much fun. This is great.
Yeah.
I'm going to go do it. Right?
Yeah.
And that's a clue too. And the clue is that to learn to recognize our pattern, and if that's our pattern, then we need to take a deep breath and not jump in right away. Give it a few days and say, you know what, I'll get back to you on that. And then we need to add more logic. And so some people need to add more intuition, and some people need to add more logic. So it depends on who you are and what your pattern is at that point in time. So understanding how our patterns have manifested in the past is very important in creating things in our lives, and that leads to the third key to manifestation, in my opinion, which is right technique. So again, it would be nice if we could just sit and meditate and visualize, you know, this great outcome, and it would just come to us a knock on our door. We wouldn't even have to go out and do anything, right? And maybe there are some people who can do that, but for most of us, you know, we have to go out in the real world and we have to implement a set of techniques to take us closer to our goal. And the problem, I think, is not that there aren't techniques. The problem is that there are too many techniques out there. I mean, if you decide you want to be a successful real estate investor, or you want to go into the movies, right, and you want to create an independent film, or you want to do a software startup, or you know, you just want to get a job in a certain industry that you're not in, usually there are too many different books out there, certainly about investing in the stock market, right? There's hundreds of books that tell you how to invest in the stock market. And the problem is not that any of them are wrong, but it's finding the right technique given your energetic pattern and what works for you. And I'll give you a great example of this that happened to me a few years back. I went to see this very famous writer, Isabel Allende, at Berkeley. She gave a talk, and I think she's nominated for or won the Pulitzer Prize or something. She's a very famous author. And she was giving a talk, and somebody asked her, well, you know, how do I write my first novel? And she said, well, here's what you do. You write a page a day, every single day. And at the end of the year, you have 365 pages. That's enough material for a novel. Now you spend some time revising it, and you've got your first novel. And I thought, well, she's a successful author. That sounds like a great technique, right? I'm hearing it from an authority on the subject. That's what I should do. So I went back and tried to do that. And it didn't work for me, turns out. That technique, slow and steady technique of a page a day, did not match with my energetic patterns. I mean, sometimes I could write 10 pages in a day, and then I would write nothing for a week. Sometimes I could write 5 pages a day, right, or an entire chapter. But I was just a very different, I had a very different pattern. And so, you know, I use that example just to say that there are many different techniques. The problem is not that there aren't techniques. The problem is, you know, the way somebody did it may not be the way that you need to do it. And that's what, you know, bugs me a lot about a lot of self-help. Like, this is the technique. Do X,
yeah,
y,
it's
Z,
always the way.
Yeah, this is the way, and you will get there.
Yeah.
Right?
Hey, I've got,
and it doesn't always work.
I have a question for you that came to mind here. Is, and this is one I work with, is how do you know, okay, so you figure out you have this pattern. How do you really reflect upon when it's good to align with it? Like, you know, really see, you know, this is a positive part of myself. And when you know when it's good to, like you say, take a step back, take a deep breath, shift it, because sometimes it seems that that's not always easy to be able to perceive when something's serving you and when it's not.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, and that's a great question. And our patterns are very much include our strengths and our weaknesses, right? I talked about this pattern in my business, and part of the reason I was an entrepreneur was because I could jump into something new and learn it really quickly and really get, you know, fully immersed in it. So that was part of my strength. In this case, it also became part of my weakness. And there's a great quote, a Chinese proverb about dragons that I think applies equally well to our energetic patterns. Our patterns are like dragons, and the quote goes like this. It goes, if you ignore the dragon, then it will eat you. If you confront the dragon directly, then it will defeat you. But if you learn to ride the dragon, then you can take advantage of its might and its power. And our patterns are like that. There's a lot of might and power in our patterns, right?
Yeah.
It's how we unconsciously create things, right? Without ever having to visualize them, we automatically create things in our lives without having to do any of this manifestation stuff, right? And so you know, I think it's important to recognize that. And unfortunately, there's no shortcut to recognizing that,
no,
but to reflect on, you know, when our patterns have served us and when they haven't. But usually, I like to go back to this idea that there are clues that are happening in our bodies. Right, and in our mind. And we can learn to pay attention to those clues. I mean, if you think about where does the energetic pattern live, it's really a way of holding our energy in our bodies and, if you believe in them, in our auras. Right? And you know, in the yogic traditions, the body and mind consist of a series of clear sheets, like clear bubbles, one inside the other. They're called kosas in Sanskrit. And what happens as we go through life is that we start to deform these sheets. We develop what they call samskaras, or imperfections, in these. And these imperfections, you know, they end up making it so that light doesn't flow so clearly into, and it doesn't flow so clearly out of what are supposed to be very transparent, clear sheets. And as we meditate and as we do yoga, we start to clear some of these imperfections. It's kind of like having a dirty windshield, right? We're all driving around with really dirty windshields, right? And you need to kind of wipe off the windshield so that you can see more clearly. And that's why I think some type of spiritual practice, and in the book I talk a lot about meditation, but it could be something more physical, such as yoga, could be walking meditations, right? That could be any type of practice that gets you into a certain state of mind. But as you do that, we start to let go of some of these inner holdings, which is what I like to call the pattern. It's a series of inner holdings that is kind of warping it into a certain shape. It's kind of like if you go over somebody's house and you see their shoes. And what's interesting is if you look at shoes when they're not wearing their shoes, they're never straight, right? New shoes are just straight. But they're always bent in a certain direction, like certainly with like tennis shoes. And they come from, you know, many days, weeks, months, years of wearing those shoes. Inevitably, they get bent into the personality and how that person holds their physical body, which is a reflection of their energy. And so, you know, our patterns are like that. But I think that if we can learn to still some of the thousand thoughts that are going on, then we can learn to see more clearly what's happening. And that's why I advocate, you know, some practice such as meditation or yoga or physical or mental. And yoga is not just a physical practice, and meditation is not just a mental practice. In fact, according to the ancient Indian traditions, they both work on these samskaras. They work on clearing these imperfections. They're just two different ways of getting there.
Yes.
Anyway, that was a long-winded answer to your question.
Yeah, and with saying different ways of getting there, we are about to hit the end of the live show. It doesn't cut us off, but I know you probably have an appointment, I'm sure. I think that we probably didn't even brush the surface totally of manifestation. Actually, there's just so much here that there's so much depth of material here. And, you know, as we head towards the end of the live show, like I said, it'll give us a slight grace period, but I want to let you go so you can go to the rest of your day. I just wanted to thank you, Riz. This has been a lot of fun having you on the show. What an interesting life you've had, and just so many interesting things. I mean, and we're just seeing a glimpse of your early path, but really, thank you so much for being here. This has been really a fascinating discussion, and I want to give you a chance to also let people know where they can find out more about you and your work.
Sure, absolutely. So you can go to my website, which is www.zenentrepreneur.com. And from there's links to Amazon, where you can find the second edition of the book. There's also links to my blog, which I update more regularly than my website. And there's a link to my Facebook page, which I update now and then as well. It's been great being here on the show. Thanks for having me today.
Well, yes, thanks again. I know I'll be reflecting on this for quite a while, and I do intend to spend more time with your book, because it is something that I feel it's a practice in itself, really, to really enter into some of the teachings there. And you have exercises, too, that I think will be helpful. So once again, I hope you have a really a peaceful afternoon, a productive and zen-type afternoon, I guess. and thanks again for being here.
Thank you. Okay, bye.
All right, take care. And with that said, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up today's program. Thank you so much to the audience for being here today. I know I'm speaking to the podcast audience now, and I always welcome your energy here in the present. Just want to say that again, say that almost every show, because I really do feel the energy of the live audience and appreciate that, or the podcast audience as well. So if you want to learn more about this show and upcoming programs, just go to frontierbeyondfear.com, which is the main website. And I'm continuing to expand that. I'm looking at upgrading it. It's taking a while, but I'll get there. I've learned a lot from our guest today, Riz, on focus. So I think we have a lot that is really helpful as well, some of his teachings in figuring out where to focus and tying up loose ends. That's another one he talks about at some point in the book, or at least addressing these loose ends that kind of they pull on our energy. So I really do invite you to explore Riz's book, which is called Zen Entrepreneurship, and the link is right on the show page, so that should be really easy for you to access that. So thank you again for being here. I'll have more shows coming up next week. And I hope you all have a peaceful time of day whenever this show finds you, and that you too begin to discover your true path and to really take joy in your journey as you encounter it and as you create it. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here.